Text or WhatsApp your view to Greg on 086 60 25,000.
Yeah, so I just had a presumption. I don't know. I never even thought about it that Croke Park was going to be pretty wedged for both Saturday and Sunday. As I say, I never really gave it any consideration. I watched it on TV and the crowd looked good at times and there were gaps, of course. Anyway, but sure, listen, it's interesting. Only 46,000 at the two matches yesterday, Greg. Nowhere near sold out. Definitely too expensive. Yeah, definitely indeed. They only managed 60,000 on Saturday, 60,000 plus, 46 then on the Sunday. That was for four games. And Croke Park, I was just reading there during the news, Croke Park has been semi-deserted for all four Dublin Championship matches played there. The total crowd for the four games featuring Dublin, 77,000, which is less than the 82,300 capacity. So there's something wrong in terms of pricing or what have you. Maybe all the talk of Dublin is going to be ground to a standstill with everything going on, discourage people from going down. I don't know. Or maybe there simply just isn't the interest and people prefer to watch it at home or maybe in the local pub. I think the attendance at Croke Park was around 49,000 on Saturday, 47,500 on Sunday. I believe the stadium holds around 82,000. You're in and around it there, yes indeed. Greg, I'm on my way to get my van's NCT test. It is a Volkswagen Caddy, smaller than most cars now. I have to get a commercial NCT for the van. It costs €117 plus €47 if a retest is required. It's a rip-off for a small vehicle. Sounds about right. Greg, done my weekly shop in Aldi last week, got my token for taking back my bottles, went to Aldi Remelton Road this week, done my shop, give them my return ticket to be told, no, you have to use them in the Aldi store you got the token from. Madness, that is. I'm really surprised at Aldi because the bottles were returned in an Aldi and another Aldi wouldn't take that token. That seems to be a major flaw in that system. You can understand maybe, you know, maybe they might want to sort of keep it within the brand, so that, in other words, you couldn't take Aldi to Dunn's, but that you can't take one Aldi voucher from one place to another Aldi, doesn't make any sense, that at all. But that's a person's lived experience. Just on the NCT too, though, it does seem a little bit random, in that we had a car in the family that went to get its NCT done. It failed on one thing. And then it wasn't driven at all because it was off the road, so to speak, and then went back and it failed another thing that wasn't the original thing, and then went back and it failed a third thing and eventually just got it over the line on the fourth test. So it can be a little bit random. Sometimes maybe it's about who's testing the vehicle as much as where it's tested. I don't know. Also, the controversy erupted just before the 10 o'clock news when a listener claimed that I have my hands in my pockets, in pictures that are put up on Highland Radio, and it looks bad. I concede it looks bad. We take a lot of pictures here. So Shannon went through the pictures, and I think going back to, I didn't ask her to do this, by the way, but over the last 3 or 4 months, I had my hands in my pockets how many times? Four times? Three? Three, four, three or four. But I admit I looked an idiot in those pictures. So noted, but it's not all of the pictures. All right. 086 60 25,000 is your WhatsApp and text number. You can give us a call on 07491 25,000. No contributory pension stamp for full-time carers. Why not? No problem with parachute payments for councillors, TDs and senators. 20 years to maybe qualify for a pension, says a listener there. Ursula von der Leyen works for the global elites, is pro-Israel and a fascist, just like her friend Zelensky. People need to start paying attention to what is happening around the world. People do, you know. It's not just a small group of people that are awake, so to speak. Lots and lots of people consume lots of media. They go on to say, though, that the US, the military-industrial complex and NATO are responsible for most, if not all, the current wars and control the West's media narrative. It is unbelievable how most people either don't care or don't know the reality which suits governments. If anyone is interested in a different point of view, eminent independent people such as Professor Sachs and others will give you a thorough rundown of facts, which are facts, though, that appeal to that particular listener. That's the problem in this day and age now, in that everyone kind of has the person they go to for the facts. And I just wonder if Professor Sachs is kind of balanced in his point of view, or is he just using his platform to push what he has to say? And then people might say the mainstream are doing the same on the other side, and never the twain shall meet. But listen, thank you very much indeed. I appreciate your text, which I have read all. Anyone interested in journalism, they say, would do well to read up on him. Thankfully, now a free man. Okay, thanks very much indeed. Why are they not looking after the people of our own country, says the listener. So many looking for a roof over their heads, and they're housing people coming into this country first. That's not in my book. That's not on in my book. This government should be ashamed of themselves. They couldn't run a hen house, says Yunan there. All right, appreciate all your contributions. It's just that view was not really reflected in the local elections, it has to be said. Right, we're going to talk more about this report, which shows a high level, a worryingly high level of malnutrition in people who are being admitted to hospital. What does it all mean? We'll find out after these. So as we mentioned on the show earlier, more than one in three patients, including older groups and people with cancer, are malnourished on admission to hospital, and levels are rising. This information was reported in a new survey. Niamh Rice is the report's co-author, and the Irish Society for Clinical Nutrition and Metabolism director. Thank you so much for joining us, Niamh. I do appreciate your time today.
Not at all. Delighted to have the opportunity to share what's an important survey, actually. It's the first we've done, the largest ever nationally, and we haven't done one for over 10 years. So really interesting to see how things have changed.
And it's a real picture across the country, isn't it? Many patients surveyed, 26 public hospitals in Ireland included.
Yeah, that's an unusually large survey. We couldn't believe we got such a great response. We had 3,600 patients, data from all of those patients, and it was a representative sample. Now, you know, the last survey, we were delighted to get 1,600 and 11,000, or rather 1,000. So this is a really big survey, which represents about one third of all of the adult inpatients on a given day in a hospital, minus the maternity patients, which weren't, you know, the relevant group. So yeah, we know that this is robust, and it found that the malnutrition rates are higher. And as I said, at least we know why. It's because people are older, and surprising part was that we had so much cancer. It's probably not surprising to people working in the healthcare system, but I think the uplift was from 16% of the population in the hospitals last time, it was 22%. That's one in five patients had a cancer diagnosis. Now, it doesn't mean that they came into hospital for cancer. It wasn't their primary diagnosis. It was just they're distributed around the hospital.
So is that really something in this highlighted in this report that perhaps needs looking at separately almost? And we'll talk about it more generally, but just the very high and much higher incidence of people with cancer in the public hospitals.
Well, you know, it's not just in the public hospitals. I don't know whether you heard the report last year, but you know, is that Ireland has the second highest cancer incidence in Europe after Denmark. But the good news is that we have better survival rates than average. So that means there's just more cancer patients about. And that's kind of good news in a way, because at least they're living longer. They're living with it. But when it comes to nutrition, they have complex nutrition problems. So it wasn't surprising to find that the people with cancer diagnosis, there were 44% of them had a high risk rate of malnutrition versus 30% in all the rest of the population, irrespective of age. And the same thing happens with age. When you just look at the age, the older patients over 65 versus younger patients, they had a 36% rate of malnutrition versus the 30%. So
just
that's
in relation,
skewing it.
Just in relation to that, Niamh, you know, everyone listening, perhaps when they hear the word malnutrition, might have an image or their own understanding of what that actually means. But sort of in this, you know, clinical setting, how is someone classed as being malnourished?
Yeah, great question, because I think we cause a lot of confusion. I don't like the word myself, because everybody immediately thinks thinness, extreme starvation. And what we're talking about is disease-related malnutrition. And that means that essentially it's a really simple concept. If you're sick, you tend to go off your food, but you also have higher requirements for certain nutrients like protein. So if you combine the effect of needing more nutrients at a time when you're eating less, the gap is wide. And over a very short period of time, your body doesn't function as well as it should do. So it means you go into a hospital in a malnourished or poorly nourished state.
So if someone went into hospital and it was deemed they needed, say, an iron transfusion, would that be classed as
No, not really. Well, we don't... Screening for malnutrition is really about whether you've had... a lot of them will have had a lot of weight loss beforehand. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yes, they might need an iron transfusion for another reason, yes. But we're talking about people who are failing to be able to eat enough to provide what their body needs to function, like to imagine an immune response. And the first thing that happens when you're not eating, even within 74 hours of semi-starvation, when you're ill and you've got an inflammatory condition, it means your immune function isn't as good. So you're much more likely to get infections or not to be able to deal with them as well. You don't heal your wounds as well. You've longer recovery time. Just because, and it doesn't matter. As I said, even if you're overweight, if you've lost weight and you're losing weight unintentionally in that period before you come into hospital, and you're not able to eat enough to keep it going, your body has to break down its muscles in order to kind of keep everything going. And it doesn't do it as well as you would in your health.
So it seems to be, looking at these figures, that the problem area and lots of areas are caught in this, where people might be, you know, long-term care, rehabilitation, etc., other hospitals, moving between hospitals. It seems to be at home where the malnutrition is happening, so to speak.
Yeah, it's always in the community. I mean, it starts in the community. So we're, you know, anybody listening and they hear hospitals, they often think, oh, the food is terrible, etc. So that's not what we're looking at, how they are when they walk into the hospital, essentially. And what we really found, I'm glad you reminded me, Greg, because the interesting thing we found, which was really surprising, was that the patients who've been in the long stay wards, the long stay patients have the lowest rates of malnutrition, but the highest rates of using nutrition support. Mm-hmm. So it had been picked up. They were getting the nutrition support they needed, so they weren't in a malnourished state. So that's brilliant, because every clinical, if you look at the papers and the research, you would find the opposite happens. The longer you're in hospital, normally the worse your nutritional status is. But in this case, we found they were lower. And patients who come in from, you know, other hospitals, they were actually, again, it was lower than the hospitals that came from home. So, you know, we know there's two things that we need to do. First of all, we need to get to the older patients who are in the vulnerable situations in home care. We know who they are. There's about 56,000 patients in receipt, or people at home living, and they're receiving home support services. And they are the vulnerable elderly that we're trying to keep in their own home. They're not in nursing homes yet, where they do get screened and treated. So I think we need to integrate nutrition screening into those patients' care, into their care package. And that's something we've called for a few years. Now, it's not practically probably going to be as straightforward or easy, but we absolutely need to do it.
I can understand what you're saying. And obviously, you're the expert in this area, so correct me where I'm wrong.
Yeah.
That would just identify more people in a different setting who are malnourished. Maybe it's for other people, but we need to be preventing people becoming malnourished in the first place. So what could we do, do you think, off the back of these findings to try and bring the numbers down?
Well, just, yeah, you're making all the right points, and thank you for, because people like me, we're so used to talking about it, we forget the obvious. We can't necessarily stop people having problems with nutrition. So we say they're at risk of malnutrition because they start losing weight. So we see the signs early. It's about picking them up at that point when they start falling down the curve. So, you know, at that point, if we were screening them in their own home and we see that they're failing a little bit, we'd be able to institute nutrition support then and maybe get them to a dietitian. So that we can try and modify their diet, maybe give them supplementation, oral supplements, and so on. So
I'm just thinking,
catching them early.
Yeah,
it's not necessarily about complete prevention.
No, of course not.
Someone who's sick becomes ill.
But just say, for instance, in relation to cancer patients, and I'm not saying it doesn't happen, I'm just saying my experience here. As you'd imagine, I've been doing this show for quite some time. I think I've covered every single element of cancer care and what have you in various interviews. I don't remember, and I'm open to correction, I don't remember us ever being asked from the HSC or what have you for someone to go on and talk about the importance of nutrition post-diagnosis, if you know what I mean, in terms of what you're... I'm more than happy to do it. Don't get me wrong.
Right.
I'm not saying it's.
I
just don't recall anyone saying, "Do you know what?" By the way, one thing you have to be really careful of on a diagnosis or as you get older is that you have to get the right foods into you at the right times or whatever it might be. So maybe there's a little gap there that could be filled. Neve, I wonder.
Oh, Greg, you know, we have failed. I think as a nutrition, I know people lambast me for this, but I think as a nutrition community, in a way, it's very difficult message to get across, you know, about malnutrition. People say, oh, that means you're thin. No, it doesn't. It means you're failing to get, you know, the right nourishment. And when you've cancer, I'm glad you mentioned cancer because there's a big gap that we've been talking about for a few years and it hasn't been filled. And that is that it's all very well getting people screened when they're walking into hospital. But cancer patients have a long journey and you've probably talked to a lot of cancer patients. So they've already lost weight by the time they get diagnosed. Everybody then focus on the tests and the cancer. They don't talk about the weight loss. They don't deal with the malnutrition. And that's when it should start. And I think also then the ambulatory care settings where they're getting chemotherapy and radiotherapy, they're actually having contact with those services all the time. But we need to extend mandatory screening to those settings where, you know, there's thousands of contact points that we have with the cancer patient well before they get into the surgery, you know, often or afterwards. So if we could actually get screening in there every time they make contact, we check their weight, we ask them about nutritional problems, we get them straight to a specialist oncology dietitian. We've only six in the country that are specialist oncology dietitians. And we have something like 34 full-time equivalents distributed across the entire country. If you look at those patients just making contact with cancer patients, but we've got 200,000 odd patients living with cancer and they have an extended period of time and things change. So we need to up the numbers of clinical specialists and you know, dedicated cancer dietitians, because there's no point in doing screening unless they can immediately see somebody to solve the problem and to give them the advice they need.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
So you're right
about saying screening is only identifying, but the only reason we screen is so that we can take action.
Oh, for sure. Definitely. And on a cancer diagnosis, you know, I presume, you know, you need to be as physically well as you can be
with that diagnosis.
Right. But, you know, obviously there's an awful lot of stress and anxiety that may influence what you take into your body. And then that can sort of maybe leave you less well equipped to go through the awful, in many cases, journey that you have to go through. It's sort of, so we really need to get at people early and get the right advice into them and say, look, it's really important that you eat this, have that.
These are
good for you, whatever vitamins are required and stuff. Listen, Neve, it's very, very interesting information and shows a very specific trend. And I think given the amount of patients surveyed and right across the country, the 26 public hospitals, it's indisputable. It gives us a real genuine insight into where we are at the moment.
Well, listen, I think it's a great opportunity and I'm glad you raised the point about communicating with cancer patients. People themselves need to understand just how important nutrition becomes if they get ill or if they have a family member. And there are ways that we can overcome appetite loss. You know, you will possibly need nutrition support. And no matter how we get it into you, we need to get it into you so that you don't lose muscle, you don't struggle to meet your nutritional requirements. And it really makes a massive difference in cancer outcomes. It improves your outcomes in terms of, you know, even dealing with the chemotherapy side effects. We know that people who are losing muscle don't tolerate the chemotherapy as well. So there's all kinds of reasons that we need to just have nutrition prioritised within medical and surgical care.
And one final point, Neve. Obviously, you know, good nutrition is vital as the body and brain develops. Have we a mechanism or a way to catch levels of malnutrition in our younger population when it's, you know, as I say, it can interfere with growth, you know, both in the physical and mental growth?
Yeah, I worked in infant nutrition for many years, actually. And infant nutrition is critically important for brain development and everything else. You sound like you know what you're talking about, and possibly you've talked to people before. The malnutrition there isn't the same because, as you said, growth is impacted. So it tends to be picked up more quickly. And it is systemized because we have checks on babies all the way through.
Brilliant.
So
yeah.
It's not the way it happens in an older person, is they can languish in a bed, you know. So quite honestly, the one thing that's worked in the past few years is that we have now got mandatory screening in public hospitals. And if we can extend that into community care settings, which we'll be dealing with, you know, politicians over the next while to try and, you know, force, you know, to move that on. I think we can really have improvements in outcomes.
Neve, thanks for so much of your time. Have a great day.
Right.
Take care of yourself.
Okay,
goodbye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Neve Rice, report co-author and the Irish Society for Clinical Nutrition and Metabolism director. I would imagine that, I'm not saying there's no information given to people who've been diagnosed with cancer in terms of nutrition. I'd imagine maybe some of the charities work very well in that area. It's just, as I say, my own experience, and I'm not saying it's not happening, so I hope I haven't upset or offended anyone, is that I've never really, I don't recall sort of a nutritional expert coming on to talk about the importance of making sure you don't become malnourished. And what we're saying there is you could go from, 15 stone to 14 stone and still appear healthy, right? But that would be classed with other indicators as malnourished. Now, the question has been asked over the weekend, why is Glenveagh Castle closed to the public? That question has been posed by independent Councillor Micheál Colm McGilla Espeg. He joins us on the programme now. Good morning, Councillor. How are you getting on?
Imagine why, Greg. I guess imagine why Dunne Eastery legally.
It's great to have you on the programme. Okay, so,
thank you.
I mean, obviously, jewel in the crown, all the usual superlatives that are used to describe Glenveagh Castle, but not accessible all of the time. So when is it being closed, or what's the story?
Well, that's the question, most definitely. And I called in to Glenveagh last week to see if there was a new manager appointed yet. And I was walking up towards the visitor centre. I saw a sign saying Castle closed. And I thought to myself, God, what's happening here? So talking to a good number of people after spending some time out there, I found out that the castle, not just on the day I visited, but also on other days, had been closed. And what I've been led to believe, and I'm waiting for, I suppose, the minister to come back to me on this here, but what I'm led to believe is that it's the lack of adequate staffing. And as somebody who lives fairly close to Glenveagh, a part of it is in my constituency. Unfortunately, the castle isn't, but the visitor centre and a good part of the walk is. And I, like everybody else in this county, pride ourselves in having this castle in our county and the fantastic, unbelievable welcoming staff that goes along with it. The grounds, the visitor centre, bus drivers, the cleaners, everybody. And to find out that the castle was closed. And just by chance, I met with a good number of people from different parts of the world. There was one family there that I kind of tic-tacked a small bit with them at the car park, and they came in a wee bit later to the visitor centre. And I would suggest that they might have been from Asia. And their parents were here for a holiday of a lifetime. And they were absolutely gutted when found out that they couldn't go to the castle, because they were quite excited about it, to visit the castle here in Donegal, where I'm assuming their children live and work. And it was sad. And there was a good number of other visitors that I did talk to and who were gutted. And I suppose for us, it's easy because we can nip in and out on different times. But if you're traveling such a long distance, need that be from Ballyclia, from Europe, or other parts of the world, you don't get many chances to visit it. So
it's not really acceptable, is it, that one of our key parts of our tourism infrastructure is not accessible routinely during the summer season, for whatever the summer is. But do you know what I mean? Like, you can obviously visit Glenveagh, do all the stuff you'd normally do. It's actually access to the castle, getting inside is what we're talking about. And I seem to remember staffing coming up as an issue here when it wasn't accessible previously. So who employs these staff? Who's responsible for this as far as we can determine?
Well, it looks like that it's the department, it's the National Parks and Wildlife who has the overall remit. And I appreciate that the National Parks remit is to conservate, and that it's by chance now that they have had the castle and the grounds over many years, but their main focus is to conservate. But there has to be something that would address this, because even on the day, talking to a good number of people, and people who would know Glenmahead very well and the castle, they were saying that there needs to be a massive investment into the castle itself. There needs to be investment so that we continue to hold the castle in the good state that it should be in, and also that we hold it as one of our main flagships for locals and then tourists within the county. It is stunningly beautiful. No more than yourself, Greg, or anybody else listening to this interview, I am fairly regular, more so a number of years gone by.
You just muted there, Micheál. If you could just unmute, you might be getting a call in there or something. Yeah,
sorry,
go ahead.
That's all right. Calling there probably to tell me that I'm on radio. But yeah, it's very disappointing, to be honest with you. I'm hoping a response.
No, you muted again. They're persistent.
Anyway,
who's ringing you?
I don't know, to be honest with you. But if you are listening, I will ring you back, as I do. But yeah, no, this is really, really important. Imagine if we had a Nyadigal cut off from tourists for the whole summer, just that thousands of tourists who land in Glenmahead every year a Nyadigal were cut off, that all the other flagship projects, any of our blue flag beaches were only open certain days, and that there was a barrier to stop people going to them. It's not acceptable.
But it's not unique to Glenveagh either. We've had we've had similar staffing problems being highlighted at Greenan of Alia, right? I just wonder, is this happening in Kerry, or is this happening in Mayo, or is this happening, you know, in Sligo or whatever, whereby, you know, your jewels in the crowns are unaccessible because of staffing in the tourism season? You know, you can't imagine, I could never imagine, you know, a hotel or a restaurant sort of saying, you know, we're not opening Friday, Saturday and Sunday because we can't get staff. Do you know what I mean? Now, I do know, by using that example, that some places have had to curtail their opening hours. But do you know what I mean? Key areas, Micheál, I hope it's not uniquely a Donegal problem. It shouldn't be happening anywhere.
I hope it's not, and this is what I'm hoping to be able to speak to the minister. I did email the minister. I actually also texted the minister as well in relation to this. What I had hoped to do is to find out who the new manager is, and I'm led to believe, and I had hoped that they would be in place by the summer, but it's going to be the end of the summer is what I've been told. That was why I initially went in to Glenmahead to find this out, because there are other projects there that I would like to see develop too. If you look at the Cúlainn Nyadigal, the back of the mountain, Chahas Lashara, that's a beautiful building lying there for many, many years. And I had spoken to others who were in management positions within Glenmahead about that. If you look at the Bridal Walk, there's a number of outbuildings there. There's buildings, the boat building, there's a number of other buildings there that are lying there that hasn't been invested in. And these are all things that our local community would like to see develop, and also those who would be attracted to come along and walk and visit our community.
Well, we've also reached out to Glenveagh and also to the minister responsible. So between the jigs and the reels, we'll see what they have to say. For your time now, I appreciate it. Thank you very much indeed. Slán.
Good to meet you, Micheál, Greg.
Slán. Bye-bye. Right, okay, Micheál Colum, McGillan Asperg there, councillor. Very, very disappointed. I wasn't aware of that. I have to be careful when I'm sort of recounting from my own memory. I do remember having a conversation with someone there as it relates to staffing, but that was also sort of during the COVID restrictions, so I can't pinpoint exactly what was going on there, but I'm not sure it's a brand new problem. But be that as it may, isn't it terrible if people travel all over the world, or even from down the country, or even from Donegal town for that matter? You go there, you probably tell your children that you'll be able to go into the castle or what have you, and then you can't because of staffing issues. That's the kind of simple stuff, isn't it, folks, that we need to be getting right? We can't be dropping the ball on silly little things like that, I don't think. we were talking to members of the RNLI because they had a number of fundraising events, and we were talking about the important work that they do. And it's not often we actually get to speak to someone who was lucky enough to have the RNLI in hand when they needed them. But we do have, by coincidence, and it's an unfortunate coincidence, but I suppose with a happy ending, Seamus Martin with us. Good morning, Seamus.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for joining us. Right, so you were out fishing on Saturday. Talk us through what it was like and then what happened to you, Seamus.
We went out fishing about 11:30 Saturday morning. It was pretty choppy, but we had a good day of fishing. And we arrived back in on Drumcraig Beach about 4:30. We tied up our main boat to the mooring, which is an 18-foot sea hog. Mm-hmm. And we got into the 12-foot punt to row back to shore when we were hit with a freak wave. It bashed a small boat up against the big one and almost capsized us.
Oh, no.
And my fishing colleague rolled in the boat and dislocated his shoulder, which left him helpless. So we managed to get back in to the bay to another mooring, and we tied up there and contacted the RNLI, which were with us within half an hour.
Wow, so you managed to stay and within the boat by luck, by the sounds of things, Seamus.
It was just pure luck that we managed to stay in the small boat. The wave came in over us and my life jacket inflated and me sitting in the boat.
Wow.
So that's
how much water you got on you, okay. And how did you manage to make contact with the RNLI from the boat?
Michael's my friend from Belfast. Michael had been out for the weekend and went fishing, so I got Michael to ring the RNLI.
Brilliant. Okay, and just highlighting the importance, by the way, reason I asked that, of having all the safety equipment with you, the life jackets, and of course a way of contacting shore. So the call was made, you just couldn't get back in from the position you were, and within half an hour, the RNLI were on scene.
They were on scene. Brilliant service. Could not recommend them anymore. And everything was set in order. We were lifted into the rib, back out into the swilly and on to the main RNLI boat, which brought us to Buncrana. And the ambulance service were waiting there for Michael.
Wow.
So everything worked out perfect. But only for the RNLI, we never would have got ashore.
Wow.
We wouldn't have a hook.
And he was in a lot of pain, I would say. Dislocated shoulder is not a pleasant experience.
I was waiting for him to pass out. The pain was so severe. And he just had a pair of shorts and a T-shirt on him as well.
Stressful enough, Seamus, for the two of you.
I never experienced anything like it. I've been fishing for the past 30 years or so with different skippers and different boats and all. I've always seen the RNLI up and down past my house here in the swilly. Always wanted to see the inside of the big boat, so I got my wish.
Yes, you certainly did. It's amazing what they do, though, is it? And the volunteers, you know what I mean? The pager goes off, they rush down, hop in, and you know what? Yeah. They didn't have to get you in terrible weather, but I often think, you know, when you hear of a trawler or something a couple of miles off the coast and the size of the waves and the swell, and they head north or they head west out into it, it really is amazing what they do, Seamus. Your rescue, as important it was to you and your fishing mate, you know, probably a walk in the park for them compared to some of the stuff that they do.
Definitely. We're talking to the skipper. He said they had already been out on a mission off Malden Head the previous, during the week at some stage, I think it was during the night, rescuing a trawler or a sailboat, which was a big operation, he said. So, and that was at night.
Amazing.
So they do an amazing job.
All right, Seamus.
And the ambulance service. So.
Would it discourage? I mean, obviously, you've 30 years fishing and a love of the water, and you've seen it all. Unfortunately, you've seen it all now following the weekend. Would it put you off going out again, Seamus? I'm sure it wouldn't.
No. I'm booked to go out from Downing now on Saturday.
Right, okay. What did you catch out of interest?
All we got was mackerel.
Mackerel?
Yeah, that's the only fish we got.
Were they
wee? We've been out for 3 or 4 hours.
Were they wee mackerel or what?
We got there were some fairly good ones, them here in the bucket and one. Cooked them later.
Lovely stuff. So out of Dannings, there's a bit of pollock in play off the pier there, maybe flats? Dogfish?
There would be. Yeah, and there's still a lot of fish out there. You had a lot of fish off Marlin Head and out over the wreck there in Ross Willie. What's the name of it there?
All right, well, listen, enjoy it. And it's great to speak to someone that can talk of the amazing work of the RNLI. We're big fans of them here. Yeah. And I hope your mate's getting on well now, too. He'll have got the best of care as well, get the shoulder popped in, and it'll take a few weeks to recover, but he'll be all right, I hope.
He'll be okay, yeah. Okay, thank
Seamus,
you very much.
Seamus, goodbye. Take care of yourself. Seamus Martin there. Just scary experience, even for someone who's experienced on the water there. 086 60 25,000, the WhatsApp and text to that number, or give us a call on 07491 25,000. Hand pocket gate rumbles on. Amazing how easy people are influenced in that. We took a picture with the lady that was in a little earlier on, and who has his hand in his pocket? Misha. So there you go. But Mary says, Greg, can't see any harm you having your hand in your pockets, whatever you feel comfortable with, Mary. It's actually sort of a little bit of discomfort. It's I don't think anyone really likes the picture getting taken. It's kind of maybe sort of a bit of a security thing. A family of five to Croke Park yesterday. Tickets, €140. Diesel, €60. Eating the way up and back around, €200. An expensive day out. Indeed it is. It is. But I mean, what's the point in charging so much money to have a half-empty stadium? Do you know what I mean? Fill it up. Is it hard to judge, though? Is it hard to judge, you know, how many people might be interested in to get the price right? I don't know. Hi, Greg. Regarding the carer's allowance, I work as a carer for my mum, and if I work out my hours, I'm getting around €6 an hour. The minimum wage, €12.70. So we're not even getting that, yeah? And there's a lot of carers get no money at all. It's brilliant to see Marie Le Pen's result in France. Well done to her, says a listener. Another on the price of going to watch Donegal play. Expensive day out, Croke Park, 45 ticket, €30 bus return, a few pints, 650 plus eat time. Have a look at things. Rip off Ireland alive and well. So the bus was 30, €75, 650 total. I hope you weren't on your own, because that would be a lot of pints. But I'm not trivialising it, but I hope there are three or four of you. You've drank the place dry. The problem with having a couple of drinks is having to dispose of them a little later on, if you know what I'm saying. I did have two in Croke Park, the Aviva Down, watching Pink. And to be honest with you, I was glad of the opportunity to go to the bathroom. It's handy enough for fellas, but you'd have to watch what you're drinking if you're a lady, because the toilets seem to be much busier. Greg, I'm just back from holiday. While there, I hired a car, which we do every year. They usually ask for a copy of my driving license. There's no issue there. Only this year, she told me, it was a year and 1 year and 6 months out of date, which means I hired a car last year with an invalid driving license. And I've been driving around Ireland with no valid license for a year and a half. We are notified when our TV license is up. Why not our driving license? Who remembers in 10 years to renew your license? Let it be a lesson to everyone this morning. Check the date on your driving license. Okay, that's interesting. Hi, Greg. Well done to Donegal yesterday. Congratulations to Jim and team. Now, let's get bigger numbers at Croke Park and get every town painted green and gold. I mean, it really is remarkable. We'll talk about it to Brendan after 11, but it really is remarkable that we're, when you think of where we were last year, that we're now prepping for a semi-final against Galway. And I thought Galway were great at the weekend too. Nutrition is the be-all and end-all of your health, says a listener. Doctors only spend a very short time on nutrition in training. And if a patient came in with an issue, they're trained to prescribe a tablet, not to actually go looking for the root cause of the issue to start. People need to be more proactive in the doctor's visit and ask questions as well as problems, indeed. You always have to, in the health service, self-advocate, I think. You can't, you know, we blindly trust our doctors, and we should as well too. You know, you have to have faith in them. They're excellent. But also too, you do have to self-advocate and look after ourselves as well. Greg, thank you for reading comments. Just to add, it isn't merely the opinions of Professor Sachs and many, many others. It is evidence-based facts, independent, no agenda facts, backed up with solid evidence. Now, whether people choose to believe it is up to them. 100%, and that's the point I was making. But there are always competing facts. And I find just, I don't know if the world has changed or I'm more frustrated with it. I'm not questioning your views or your opinions, and I think you picked that up in your second message. I get that. But, you know, for every one person that has an opinion on this side and can quote scientists and doctors and eminent professionals, there is another group on the other side that can do the same, and it aligns to their point of view. And I just find it really quite sore on the head. I went to a shop in Buncrana a few weeks ago and returned my bottles. I put them all through the machine, but before my receipt printed, an error came on the screen and I didn't get a receipt. I went into the shop and told the cashier that there was a problem with the bottle return. She said, no, there isn't. I fixed it 10 minutes ago. I said, well, it's taken my bottles and I didn't get a receipt. She shrugged her shoulders and said, can't help you with that. I left the shop fuming. What's the point in going to the trouble of collecting the bottles and bringing them back when you have staff with that attitude? Well, I would have looked for a higher up there, to be honest with you. I wouldn't have just walked away in that situation. And Aldi, which is the shop in question, perhaps would be very interested in that as well. You know, it is a hassle. It's a pain. We didn't have to do it before. We were usually using our recycle bins before. I think I would have stood my ground a bit there, but I understand it's different maybe when you're there in the heat of the moment. Right. We have loads coming up in the next hour, talking about different types of stuff, a little bit more lighthearted and featurey as well, so stay tuned for that. It is the 9 till noon show here on Highland Radio. Back with more after these.